So it's my pleasure tonight to welcome back to Many Rivers Books and Tea the eminent and illustrious Gus DeZeriga, PhD, author of the evening books, blog author,
provider of small fish.
Provider of small fish. He has donated small fish to our pond and many other virtuous things in his life. So he is also, of course, the author of his latest book project, Fault Lines, the 60s, the Culture War, and the Return of the Divine Feminine. That's why you're here. That's why he's here. That's why I am glad to have you join me in welcoming Gus DeZeriga to Many Rivers Books and Tea.
Thank you very much for showing up on an evening when there were so many other alternatives. I appreciate your being here. Some of you may have read Fault Lines because Many Rivers has had it for a while now. It came out on my birthday, November 12th, last year, which I took as an auspicious event. Either that or I was another year closer to death, so it could be interpreted either way. But I come to writing on spiritual topics from a somewhat non-normal direction. I was a PhD candidate, then later PhD in political science, not one of the more spiritual disciplines in America, at Berkeley, and met a fellow while I was selling my artwork on Telegraph, which is how I financed my research. I joked I was the starving academic who did art for a living, who claimed to be able to do magic, and I dared him because I knew he couldn't, and he could, and my life changed rather dramatically while still continuing to be a proper political scientist. And so it took at least 20 years before I thought I could integrate those two dimensions of my life in a way that did not seem forced and that could do justice to both. And Fault Lines really is the first of a projected, I think, will be three volumes dealing with the same topic from different directions. The first one, my first book was my PhD dissertation, so that was traditional social science. The second was Pagans and Christians, which is from a pagan perspective, looking at the differences between the two in a very broad level. And then some co-authored pieces, but this is the first where I've really tried to bring them together. And as such, the book is very complex. I hope it's also very readable. People tell me it is, and I hope it's not because they're just trying to be nice. But I can't cover everything in it in any one talk. And so what I thought I would do tonight is start with some interesting statistics that the book does not go into very much, although it goes into the underlying causes a great deal. And that is, it seems to me that the sort of cultural divide that has happened in the United States can in a way be symbolized by projects from the two sides, if I can use that dichotomous way of talking for the moment. One group, centered on evangelical Christians in the South, has pushed over and over and over again to have stone or concrete or otherwise solid reproductions of the Ten Commandments on public property, in courthouses, in front of city halls, whatever the case might be, which raises the whole issue of separation of church and state. And about 75% of Americans a few years back thought that they should be able to have things like that. It was not really that oppressive to anybody. So you have a country where not only was that kind of thing moderately common throughout the country a few decades ago, but most Americans, if it was put to a vote, would probably say, whatever. And it's part of our heritage. The other has to do with gay marriage. But before we get to that, I want to look at some very interesting statistics about religious affiliation in the United States. So I'm, the first part of this talk is social science. It's not going to end up there, but it's going to start there. In 1990, about 8% of the American people told, I think it was Pew, that they did not have a religious affiliation. That did not mean they thought of themselves as atheists. It just meant they did not affiliate with any established church or religion. By 2008, it had about doubled, which is a fairly rapid rate of increase. And by 2013, it was up to 20% that had that point of view. And what's interesting about that is that it's also skewed by age. And so the older the population is, the more likely it is to identify with a religion. And generally speaking, the number of people who say they're unaffiliated with a particular faith is more than double who'd say that they were not affiliated as children. As of now, one third of 18 to 29 year olds claim no religious affiliation. So if that statistic by some chance can be extrapolated, which we have no way of knowing at this point, that means a majority of the American people will not have a religious affiliation by the time these people are considerably older. At the same time, if you were to go back to 1996 and asked Americans, what do you think of gay marriage? Most would have said, what? And of the ones that would have approved, it was 27%. Others, if they weren't anti-gay, would say, well, what's wrong with civil, civil procedures? Leave it at that. This year, 55% of the American public is in favor of gay marriage. This is an extraordinary change in public opinion about a very traditional institution that people have taken more or less for granted as far back as anyone can remember. But it's not alone. There's another interesting statistic I put down here. In 1958, only 4% of the American people thought that the different races, especially blacks and whites, should be able to intermarry. Somebody like Obama would have been illegal. In 1968, 10 years later, it had risen 17% of the white population, and this time the pollsters tried to distinguish by race, and over 50% of the black population. By 2011, 84% of whites, 96% of blacks. So again, something that had been very stable, I think it could be safely said, as a statistic, for 100 years, from 1858 to 1958, I rather doubt it was ever much above 4%, suddenly changed dramatically. We all know what's happening to legalizing marijuana. It's passing in states by popular vote. On premarital sex, in 1969, at the height of the crazy 60s, 75% of Americans disapproved. In the early 80s, 33% to 37% disapproved. A majority said, fine, no problem. Again, a dramatic change. And many of us probably know families of friends where the son or the daughter is shacking up with their boyfriend or girlfriend well before marriage is ever on the table and the parents are fine with it. Certain types of fundamentalist Christians say, well, this is a sign of moral degeneracy, moral decline. of the collapse of standards in American society. And that's why the following statistic is really interesting. In 1972, 67% of the American people opposed adultery as wrong, which suggests that perhaps the other 33% had a guilty conscience. In 2010, 78% opposed adultery as wrong. Now, in that case, they've done the statistics, or they've done the questions fairly often, and it sort of goes like that. But the trend, if there is a trend, is up. More and more people disapprove. And this, I think, suggests a problem. We're not seeing a moral decline. We're seeing a moral redefinition. Why? What's going on here? It seems to me that, as is obvious from anybody who watches Fox News and lives in Sebastopol, a deep cultural bifurcation is growing in the United States. It's almost like two different countries in one, to a degree that we have not seen since the Civil War. And one wonders, why? What is this happening? I think that the recent events in Ferguson give us a clue. Because I'm a somewhat public figure in certain circles, I have a whole lot of Facebook friends that I've never met and never will meet, over 800. And I use that as a way of providing not what did I eat for breakfast, but interesting news combined with other entertaining things like a wonderful YouTube of a little baby elephant playing with a ribbon, or the latest events in Iceland with its volcanoes. Very interesting. But it's mostly a way of giving information that I've got the time and I'm hopefully expertise to find to people who don't have the time, even if they have the expertise. Some of them seem to appreciate it. So I covered events in Ferguson fairly well, with links to stuff that was not usually easily available. And what I found was very interesting, because I have a few conservative Christians on it, mostly because they want to see what the pagan is up to. And a guy out of Tennessee, but he was Lutheran, probably Missouri Synod, judging from when I went and looked at his site, had a very different reaction to Ferguson than I did. And I emphasize his religion because he saw himself as coming from a very moral place, as did I see myself as coming from a very moral place, that drew completely opposite conclusions as to what was happening in Ferguson. And we debated for a while online until finally I got tired of the fact that he ignored everything I brought up. And so I defriended him, which I don't do very often. But I was pretty upset over what was happening in Ferguson. And then I thought about it. And I thought what was interesting was that he sincerely believed he was taking the standpoint of morality. What was the difference? He looked at what was going on in Ferguson in terms of what I would call hierarchical views of right and wrong with firm boundaries. It is wrong to steal cigars. It is wrong not to be properly deferential to lawful authority. If the authority overreacts, that's your bad luck. But if you hadn't done it, you'd be fine. it's the same kind of mentality that goes with wanting the Ten Commandments: firm boundaries, and in both cases, ignoring contexts. My view was that I didn't know for sure what the heck had happened in Ferguson to set things off. It looked like the cops were hiding things, and the more it goes on, the more it looks that way. But the context of abusive relationships between the police and the majority of Ferguson's citizens changed the significance of everything else that happened in that community. I was looking at it in terms of relationships and open boundaries. He was looking at it in terms of hierarchies and closed boundaries. Does that point make sense? Both from the standpoint of the person holding them being very moral. And this, I think, is what's going on in the country. But why? And that gets to why, in a way, I called the book Fault Lines. That the United States does have two separate countries within it. But it's more interesting than that. It's also undergoing one of the most fundamental shifts, or I should say Western civilization, is undergoing one of the most fundamental shifts human society has ever undergone, in my judgment. The only other time that approximates it was the shift from hunting-gathering societies to agricultural societies many thousands of years ago. We are now shifting from agricultural societies that are rural to industrial societies that are urban. And with that comes an enormous amount of change, some of it very paradoxical. Those rural societies tended to really emphasize the importance of boundaries. How did land get passed down? By virtue of who was the proper descendant. And so, by God, you better know who your kids were, and that meant you kept the women under control. It also made it possible for steep hierarchies of status and power to arise. Agricultural societies, when they became large, usually had either slaves or serfs or peasants and aristocrats with different levels of law applying to different groups. This was even true for ancient Greece. And if we look spiritually, I want to make an important distinction between spirituality and religion. Given that you're at Many Rivers, probably everybody here has some kind of inner spirituality that's extremely important to you, as it is to me. Some of you may also practice a religion, as I do. They're not the same. I want to suggest, if you look into where you are and who you are, your spirituality includes dimensions that are not part of your religion. Because your religion is what we practice with other people. That's part of its strength, it's also part of its weakness. It's a social thing. What we believe in our heart of hearts obviously has to be at peace with our religion, but it doesn't have to be the same thing exactly. I'm Wiccan, and I'll never forget the first time I was in a coven, and we almost never talked about beliefs. It's a religion of practice primarily. And if you do the practice together, it's a great group, and if you don't, it's a group where you look elsewhere. But every now and then we would talk about beliefs, we'd find out that we interpreted what we were doing very differently a lot of the time. And it didn't matter. Spirituality was one thing. What you did together with other people is another. And if you look at American Catholics, They certainly practice the Catholic religion, but a high percentage of them use the pill. Clearly, there's some redefinition going on. And I want to suggest there's a lot of that, because we're all individuals. All right. Religion, because it's social, influences and is influenced by the society it exists in. And so, if we look at the religions of agricultural societies, they tend to be hierarchical. And in the monotheistic ones in particular, they tend to be transcendent. Spirit is up there, we're down here. The world is in some sense screwed up. And particularly in the Abrahamic traditions, firm rules everywhere. It fits a society where protection of boundaries is important, where knowledge of where you stand in the pecking order is important. And it fits, and it fit very well for thousands of years. And by the way, if I say anything that seems wrong or you want to know more about, please raise your hand, because I may or may not get to it on my own later on. This kind of society in the U.S. had a sort of mutation, and it came from, I think, two facts. One is that England, because it was disconnected from Europe, never had quite the same militarized hierarchical society that Europe, the mainland, did. You had a little bit more in the way of free institutions, pretty much all the way back, which is why they could say the Magna Carta, even though it was written only for nobles, could be built on to become a major feature of the British Constitution. And so for a variety of reasons, England was the society where what we call liberalism first developed as a major political force. And liberalism was interesting in the context I just presented, because it said the individual is the ultimate moral unit of society. But it was a liberalism that was still very much concerned with boundaries. And although at the human level the hierarchy was flat. Then, because of religious war and intolerance on all sides, really, a great many of the early sects of the English Protestant era came over here, where they could be intolerant in their own way. But over here, the people who had previously filled this continent were wiped out largely by disease, and what those that weren't were wiped out in other ways. You don't have to go into that, I assume we all know that. And so you had a creation of independent farmers in the north, no military, and liberal values, which you saw in the Declaration of Independence. It's almost like John Locke wrote it. And so in a sense, agricultural society had a chance to get restarted without slaves and without strong hierarchies. In the South, it was a little different. You had, in the North, soon after the American system was created, a majority of the first states abolished slavery. Not only did they abolish slavery, some of the more northern states gave women the right to vote. New Jersey wrote into their constitution he or she explicitly, and even gave, and some states even gave free blacks the right to vote in the north. That's a little feminist factoid that most feminists don't know. Who's the first American state to give women the right to vote protected under the Constitution? New Jersey. And a number of others did if the women were not married. The belief was if you were married, you'd do what your husband told you to do. So if you hadn't been married yet, or if you were a widow, you could vote, but you couldn't if you were in between. Because that just meant your husband had two votes. But New Jersey went beyond that. culturally it was a step too far, it didn't last, but that was what was attempted based on the principles of the revolution. In the South, you had a movement in the other direction, which was that slavery became very profitable. With the invention of the cotton gin, the original founders were disproportionately Southerners who owned slaves, because that was basically the only way you could make money in the South, but disapproved of it, didn't know how to get rid of it, but thought in time it would disappear on its own. They were wrong, and the next generation found themselves getting very rich through slavery and had to basically rethink their position to the Declaration of Independence, because its logic was deeply anti-slavery. And the way they rethought it is to say, well, the founders were wrong. And so the South had to create a new foundation for a legitimate slave society, because the principles of the American Revolution were subversive to it. And that began a process that led to a very, very different culture than existed in the North. What happened in the North? We often think of the 60s, and this gets to the point I was going to talk to you about, as being different. One of my favorite quotes, which I start the chapter on the 60s with, is by one of my favorite authors, Tom Robbins. Maybe it was sentimental, if not actually stupid, to romanticize the 60s as an embryonic golden age. Certainly this fetal age of enlightenment aborted. Nevertheless, the 60s were special. Not only did they differ from the 20s, the 50s, the 70s, etc., they were superior to them. Like the Arthurian years at Camelot, the 60s constituted a breakthrough, a fleeting moment of glory, a time when a significant little chunk of humanity briefly realized its moral potential and flirted with its neurological destiny, a collective spiritual awakening that flared brilliantly until the barbaric and mediocre impulses of the species drew tight once more the curtains of darkness. I like that. But the 60s were not quite as unique as Robbins says here. They were unique on one issue more than the other. There were more of them, of us. In particular, and I'm going to read, there are two places I'm going to read from my book. In particular, the 60s shared strong affinities with the ferment and creativity that enriched the United States after the War of 1812. Until then, the new country had been preoccupied with survival and establishing basic political institutions. When peace came and the founding generation began to fade into memory, Americans' attention turned towards building new lives within the world's first close approximation to a liberal democracy. As the impact of political freedom began to work its magic, Americans responded, some to enrich their bank accounts, some to enrich their lives. By the war's end, universal white male suffrage existed in many states, and slavery had been abolished in a majority of states. Women's rights, abolition, labor reform, health reform, marriage reform, better treatment of Native Americans, prison reform, abolition of the death penalty, and even free love were familiar themes within the more spiritually innovative communities of this time. Utopian communities were established by secular and religious reformers. Does that sound like the 60s? It does to me. But this was the 1840s, and so we have people like culturally innovation was closely tied to spiritual innovation. Upstate New York was the San Francisco of its time. The burned-over district, spiritual energy, energized America's second great awakening. Sarah Pike, who teaches at Chico, describes this period as a time, quote, of communal experiments that rejected traditional marriage arrangements, seances in which spirits spoke through adolescent girls. I'll add a footnote or a parenthesis. There was a room for seances in the Lincoln White House. Hypnotic trance healings, cures using water baths, herbal healing, homeopathic medicine, interest in yoga and meditation. God was described as feminine as well as masculine, mother as well as father, even by male religious reformers. Popular Christianity emphasized emotion over doctrine in its services and supported the reform movements of the time. While most religious creativity was broadly Christian, the new openness and optimism led many Americans to learn from other spiritual traditions. The rise of New England Transcendentalism marked the first hesitant influence of non-Abrahamic religions in American cultural life. Mesmerism and the teachings of Emanuel Swedenborg, numbered between four, became important influences as well. At its height, spiritualism, numbered between 4% and 8% of Americans, and spiritualist practices provided the earliest forms of religious and political leadership for American women. The period also generated a powerful peace movement protesting American military aggression. The Mexican-American War triggered citizen protests proportionately larger than those opposing the Vietnam War. Former President John Quincy Adams attacked the war as a Southern ploy to expand territories suitable for slavery. And future President Abraham Lincoln spoke out in opposition on the floor of the House, condemning President Polk as a liar during wartime. We didn't see anything like it in the 60s. Transcendentalists such as Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau also opposed the Mexican-American War. Thoreau's On Civil Disobedience argued that it was everyone's duty to have nothing to do with murderous imperial ambitions. He advocated peaceful civil disobedience intended to push otherwise complacent citizens into confronting the moral implications of governmental murder. So the 60s were part of a venerable American tradition, rooted in the logic of the country's founding and taking its basic principles seriously rather than just something to wear as a pasty on the 4th of July. That was supposed to be a humorous rumor. In other words, there was a split in American society that did not exist except in embryo at the time of the country's founding. Liberal modernity undermined hierarchy and in doing so set forth the changes I described, while the South, having to defend slavery, had to reject liberalism and therefore look backwards towards the hierarchical agricultural societies of the past, as it still does. Okay, so there is one dimension of the bifurcation. It's the most visible, the easiest to grasp, and in some ways the most intractable. You have an area whose dominant culture sees the world in moral terms, very much like many of us do, but in decidedly different moral terms. Terms that fit a hierarchical agricultural society that do not fit an urban, complex, industrial one. That's not accidental that Sarah Palin, who, while she's from Alaska, is a Pentecostal, talked about rural Virginia as the real America, as some people may remember. So what did modernity do? Because it really undermined every aspect of the old traditional society in ways that nobody anticipated, because liberalism grew out of it. If you read John Locke, he's into firm boundaries, a mechanistic view of the world. Nature is something for us to control. It's a resource for us and nothing more. His ideal was somebody like the small farmer. Jefferson, the ideal, the small farmer. Well, moral equality does one thing before all other things. It expands the realm of choice. The number of people that you can cooperate with as an equal grows phenomenally. Religious toleration grows out of it. And that too expands choice, because what once was considered an absolute religious truth, suddenly you've got two or three absolute religious truths all claiming and clamoring for your allegiance. You can't help but realize you've got a choice. Science, which eroded traditional religious authority. Democracy eroded social authority traditionally. When the founders started the American system, their vision was, as the dominant people in their culture, they would let it be known that they were standing for election. And then, by virtue of their reputation, people would support them and vote for them. That lasted about one election. Because they discovered a lot of other people decided to stand for election and then work at meeting people and getting them to vote for them. And so, the notion of traditional hierarchies competing against each other for the common vote based on their personal morality and excellence didn't last. And so even though the founders disapproved of political parties, Jefferson and Madison started the first one out of necessity. And then the Federalists picked up and did theirs as well. And we were off and running. Economic prosperity that grew out of this meant that there was more safety and prosperity in life than before. Europe, to give an example where we've got the history to back it up, was continually bothered by famines for most of its history. They were usually localized. Once railroads were built, Europe never had another famine until the Nazis caused one in the Netherlands, and I'll get to later. Because you could move food quickly, and famines were over. Didn't have to worry about that. And so what was happening was that people's sense of who they were and how they were in the world began to shift. And my favorite early commentator on the United States was a Frenchman, Alexander Tocqueville. Some of you may have heard of him. He wrote, I think, the greatest book on America ever written by anybody, called Democracy in America, in two volumes. And in one very small chapter, he was a good Catholic, but he was also a very astute observer. And in one of his smaller chapters, and hardly anybody ever talks about this passage, Tocqueville wrote, as conditions become more equal, the human mind seeks to embrace a multitude of different objects at once, and it constantly strives to link up a variety of consequences with a single cause. Ultimately, one seeks to expand and simplify his conception by including God and the universe in one great whole. Of all the different philosophical systems used to explain the universe, I believe that pantheism is one of those most fitted to seduce the human mind in democratic ages. Tocqueville didn't like this, he said, and we must fight against it with all our power, because it was the absolute opposite of the Catholic worldview. But it fits an immanentist worldview. And many religions today are adopting or endorse or practice that worldview in this country. And indeed, the American love affair with nature, with the national parks, which are often, even in the secular press, described as America's cathedrals, emphasizes this different attitude. Even as American capitalists are doing everything they can to cut down those cathedral forests and mine those cathedral parks. But what was going on was that hierarchy was being rejected in both secular and spiritual contexts, and that led to the, I think, the most profound transformation since the rise of agriculture. There was a philosopher and scholar of religion called Carl Jaspers. Who described what he called the axial age. Anybody here heard that term? Okay, some have. Now my professorial side is coming. Anybody want to try to define it so it's not me talking all the time? Jim?
Well, about 500 BC, there was a major change. Larger cities, but you saw a shift in religious practices, and Jaspers was referring to the fact that Socrates, the Buddha, Confucius, all of them, and others, Zoroaster, all emerged at the same time. So something was happening to humanity at that time, which shifted the way they understood existence.
Right. And what was happening was that the religious foundation of I would argue, Jasper says, interprets it somewhat differently than I, because he didn't think anything was going to happen for another age. I think we're beginning to see one. But this religious heritage of hunting and gathering societies didn't work very well in hierarchical city-states and empires. For one thing, hunting gatherers don't have words for things like weed or vermin. They don't have to worry about famine very much because you can pick up and move. But if you've got a field, it's a little hard to move it. And so you're getting a very different mindset towards the natural world. Becomes more threatening in a way. The gods become more fickle. Hunting gatherers emphasized harmony. Agricultural peoples tended to be more interested in salvation or enlightenment or some way to get off the wheel of existence because it was miserable here. Harmony was not really in their order of priorities. At least for the more sensitive people there who could appreciate the suffering around them. And so you had a fundamental religious shift that involved the control and fear of nature, extreme social hierarchies, patriarchy, and domination replaced different but relatively equal roles for men and women. Hunting-gathering societies definitely had distinctions between what most men and most women did, but they didn't regard them as hierarchically. As a sweat leader on the Crow Reservation told me once, he said, all these Germans come and they want to learn, and he's happy to teach them, and the women get upset when he says he prefers to lead sweats with just men, and then the women can lead their own sweats. And he says, well, if they want to come, they can. But he tells him you'll have more fun with the women's sweat. So it wasn't a putting down. It was a case of separate roles. And if somebody really wanted to cross roles, in many, at least the Native American societies, I know what you could. If that's what you wanted to do. It was not like an agricultural society or society of herders. The religions of tribes, hunter-gatherer tribes, tended to have flat hierarchies. Shamans were doctors, or they were people who could find lost stuff, they were people who could tell you or work with the weather, but they weren't spiritual authorities for everybody, and to the degree that they did place something akin to that, it was to help the tribe as a whole restore harmony. Okay, those were agricultural religions. But I look at my Buddhist friends in this country, and I've yet to meet one who's a Buddhist primarily because they want to be off the wheel of birth and rebirth. That's not what they talk about as to why Buddhism appeals to them. It appeals to them for harmony, for balance, for bringing things into greater equanimity. But to get off birth, rebirth, that's just not really a primary motivation. Does that fit other people's experience? Yeah. It was a one time, it was a big deal. It's not anymore. And this, I think I want to say, illustrates what's happening to traditional religions with a post-agricultural mentality among their practitioners. They either have to change, or they will become less and less and less prevalent. In my book, I talk about how the Dalai Lama, Tibetan Buddhism is about as patriarchal and hierarchical as a religion can get. And I can imagine thinking of the scene from The Exorcist. Many a conservative lama's head spinning around on his shoulders when the Dalai Lama said, "I'm a feminist." But that spinning probably became hypersonic about a year ago after the book came out when he said, "Maybe the next Dalai Lama will be a woman." That's a change. That's about as big a change as you could ask. And when an emanation of Avalokiteshvara says that, it has a little cachet. So the second axial age is the shift from an agricultural spiritual world to one rooted in cities. And we'll say, well, here we are, we all live in Sebastopol, and I certainly live in Sebastopol in part because it's not a city. That's true. And I imagine many of us are here because we don't want to live in a big city. How many want to live in Wairika? Sebastopol is great because it's in the cultural orbit of a big city, as well as having the benefits of being a small community, except for its traffic. So we get the best of both. But I imagine most of us, if given a choice between San Francisco and Wairika, would pick San Francisco. Unless we had some really good friends in Wairika. Or Alturas. Or Bakersfield. Or anybody else there, I don't know. I'm sorry. I really don't know. Why would they settle there to begin with? So so what's happening? We're having one of the big changes is our standpoint to nature. We're not trying to control it as farmers. The people at the farmers market here in Sebastopol, most of them have chosen to become farmers. It's not their fate in life. And that's a very different mentality to take into growing things. When we leave our work and go on vacation into nature, or just take a walk in nature, it's to chill out, to put things in perspective, to feel connected with God's world, so to speak. That's a different mentality than someone who walks out and says, "Oh, look at all those board feet of lumber."
Just one question. I don't know if you're going to get to this.
Go ahead.
But what about the possibility that, okay, so you talked about the benefits of industrial society, but aren't there a lot of markers indicating that it's going absolutely too far in so many different directions? So all of these things that you're talking about are actually extremely threatened, whether it's...
Well, they most certainly are extremely threatened, and they're threatened from two different directions. one of which I'm not talking about tonight because it's so complicated on its own, and that is that, I'll make a quick extremist comment. People talk about artificial life, trying to create it. We have. They're called corporations. And it's why I make a distinction between civil society and capitalism. And I'll give a couple of examples in a minute. Civil society is that society that grows up among people of status equals who are free to cooperate on whatever they want to do. And that includes creating businesses, making a fortune possibly, or becoming an artist, or a farmer, or whatever. Or building model trains. It doesn't matter. It's the realm of freedom. Capitalism is that part of a market that frees itself from civil society and therefore from human beings. Let me describe an example from Northern California. How many remember the timber wars? Okay, how many remember Pacific Lumber? Pacific Lumber for a long time was a family-owned company that made a profit cutting redwood forests in Northern California. It was also very favorably described by the Sierra Club. Why? Because while they wanted to make a profit, they wanted to do other things too. They lived in the area, they had a sense of noblesse oblige probably, and so they integrated making a profit with a lot of other values. And so they were very, very popular. They decided, sadly, that they needed to raise capital for something, and the best, quickest way to raise it was to go public with stock and become a joint stock corporation. As soon as you do that, you enter the world of capitalism. The reason is because if you've allowed any value other than making money to influence what you're doing, it lowers the value of your stock over what it would be if all you were interested in was making money. And so once those shares are available, corporate raiders who are interested only in making money can raise the money to buy control of the company, get rid of the things that are getting in the way of it making as much money as possible, and make a killing. That's the basic logic. As soon as that happens, the corporation ceases to be really a reflection of human values and becomes a reflection of market values or capitalist values, because if you are a corporate CEO and doing something ethical gets in the way of maximizing those shares, you will be ousted as soon as somebody can organize an effective challenge. We just saw an attempt to do that with a market basket supermarket chain in New England, where it was a family-owned chain, very much in that sense like Pacific Lumber, and one part of the family decided they wanted to make, it was profitable, they wanted to make more money and possibly make more money by selling it to another company who would then get rid of the fact that they paid their workers more than any other supermarket in the area and still were profitable. But if you could cut workers and cut hours and cut wages, the CEOs and shareholders would make still more money. And so there was a big fight in which you found the workers going out on strike to support the old CEO who'd been fired, and the consumers refusing to buy, many of them, in order to support the old CEO who had been fired so the corporations could take over. And in this case, this time around, the old CEO and the values he stood for won. Last I heard, he was able to get enough people together to buy shares from family members who were supporting selling the store off. And Market Basket would continue to be Market Basket, and therefore part of civil society, not part of capitalism. But Pacific Lumber was not so fortunate. There's a wonderful book. How many people here like chocolate? Okay. There is a wonderful, wonderful book that goes into all of this, although that's not the reason she wrote it, called Chocolate Wars by Deborah, you'll know the name, Cadbury. And it's a history of the chocolate industry in Britain and the U.S., including what happened at the end when Cadbury, for a variety of reasons that had nothing to do with its profitability, had to go public and got taken over by Kraft. Cadbury chocolates are not Cadbury chocolates anymore. They're Kraft chocolates using Cadbury labels. And already they've started undermining issues that the company was long noted for. Won't go into it. It's an interesting book. There are lots of cases like this. It's basically who gets to the top of a capitalist company? Somebody who's in harmony with that way of thinking. What do we call them? Sociopaths. No, I'm serious. You can come up with a better name, let me know. Somebody who looks upon everybody else as a means to their end, which is making money. It's not by accident that Atlas Shrugged is popular with them. Okay, so there, you know, there is a deep struggle between a human society and an inhuman society going on in this country today. This struggle, the struggle between the South and the North, if you will, prevents us from even addressing it. And it's one reason I think the country should split up. But that's a whole other issue. I could be wrong. But if Texas were gone, I think we'd be doing a whole lot better. But in any event, the book doesn't go into that because I don't know. Those are complex issues. This is complex enough for me.
I mean, you raise an interesting point, which is that don't you think the geographical split, although still somewhat statistically accurate, is quite intermixed now, and that's one of the features of modern society, where these fault lines exist like they used to, but they're not located so much as regionally as they used to be.
It's more blurry than it used to be. Yeah, and that's why I'm not sure that this is the solution. If it were going to happen, I'd say, but this, I think it's in 2015 that the Scots are going to vote on whether or not to leave the UK. So,
no, it's this year.
Is it this year?
September 18th.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And I'm rooting for them for obvious reasons. In this case, I would say, hypothetically, but I don't want to get sidetracked because it's not really what any of you came here to hear about, is if it was going to happen, you'd have a 5-year period before it became official, and then you'd have a second vote during which people could move if they wanted to. But, you know, who knows? But when you've the logic of the Constitution was based on consensus, not majority rule. That's its underlying logic. And when you don't have consensus, it doesn't work. And we see that today. It's not a case of me being a wild man. It's a case of saying the logic of the document presupposed a degree of consensus in the society that does not exist anymore. Will it come back or not? And how long before it comes back, if it comes back? I mean, those are the questions to think about. All right. Anyway, the second axial age, not only has this different view of nature, it's like, where do we find the support for ecology? The countryside or the cities? Cities.
Mm-hmm.
Where do we find people who like to go to the national parks the most? Cities. Where do we find people who are most concerned about global warming?
cities.
Over and over and over and over again. It's maybe not what you think. So that one of the, you know, issues of the future, if we have a future, is making the cities themselves greener. Feminism, which is a big, is an important part of the book that I really haven't talked about much, but you know, the return of the divine feminine is certainly a crucial part of it. As soon as you start breaking down hierarchies and boundaries, you start entering a world of more feminine values. I'm not talking about genetic men and genetic women and trans and all the rest of that stuff. I'm talking about what in China are called yin and yang, but in the West and in many other societies are often described as feminine masculine. And in China, if you ask, the masculine is yang and the feminine is yin. So we're talking about a complex of values. And the book goes into to that in some depth. So the book argues, in fact, that nature and the role of women and feminine values are the two biggest pivotal points on which the culture wars are being struggled over. I think that's a pretty safe statement. What are the spiritual implications? This is the last thing I'm going to read, last thing I'm going to say, so there's questions and people can go home or whatever. I haven't talked too much about spirituality, but the book ends on it, big time. And chapter 11, Dimensions of Perfection. Starts with a little quote by David Abram, one of my favorite authors. The aboriginal intuition of a resplendence immanent in matter accords well with the new sense of the sacred now striving to be born. Sacred immanence heals the rift between religion and science. The god of ever-diminishing gaps is an artifact created by adherents to transcendental monotheism seeking to keep their faith while respecting reason and knowledge. They wisely rejected fundamentalist irrationalism, but at the cost of ceding an ever-increasing field to secular science and an ever-diminishing field of divine involvement in the world. As the gaps narrowed, this position led many people to unbelief and others to belief rooted in will alone. But these unfortunate choices arise from an inappropriate conception of the sacred. From the standpoint of sacred immanence, there are no gaps, no place where the sacred is absent. From an immanentist perspective, nothing in the world is meaningless. Everything, every it, as a dimension, as a thou, a presence, a context of meaning. We accomplish this kind of integration with our loved ones every day. In principle, and for many of us in practice, we can do this with everything. In doing so, we enter the realm best described through mythos and poetry, where the good and the beautiful are dimensions of the true, as the true is a dimension of them. Recognizing sacred immanence heals our alienation from this world. The axial faiths generally separated the individual from primary identification with the world and the human community, both of which had become threatening. They focused people on their individual relationships to the sacred for salvation, release, or final exit. A genuinely postmodern spirituality now opens a way to reconnect with our world and with one another from a heightened sense of individuality. Far from limiting or stifling our individuality, relationships are necessary for us to grow and to flower. When people enlarge their circle of thous, thereby shrinking their world of its, greater love and compassion are a natural result achieved not because of divine commandment to avoid damnation or from rational self-interest, but as an individual recognition that these qualities are our most appropriate way to relate. As Rabbi Lawrence Kushner writes, human beings are joined to one another and to all creation. Just as historically religions of pure transcendence privileged the masculine, so religions of immanence tilt towards the feminine. So far as we know, however, such religions in the past did not denigrate the masculine, certainly not in any degree equivalent to what religions of transcendence did to the feminine. Masculine qualities are also essential parts of immanence. Duality manifests as both feminine and masculine, and when duality is recognized as sacred, so are they. Acknowledging the divine feminine opens us to a wider and deeper range of insight about our lives, our world, and the sacred. In secular modernity's most accomplished way of learning, science itself, feminine qualities of knowing are as crucial as masculine ones. I go into that in the book. Science cannot understand itself nor make the breakthroughs in knowledge for which it is so justly celebrated when committed only to masculine logocentric styles of thought. As a society priding itself only on its masculinity, be it the ideal of the neoconservatives, fundamentalists, or any others, is parasitic on its feminine elements, which it could not survive without, but refuses to acknowledge. And the last little bit that I really like. Peter Berger is a sociologist of religion, and he wrote a book about religion in the future, and he said there was a contrast between the religions of Jerusalem, meaning the Abrahamic traditions, and the religions of Benares, meaning the Asian views of some kind of non-reality of the ego, ultimately. Jerusalem, I add San Francisco, because that, as I show, is ground zero for most of what happened in the 60s. It's really quite remarkable. In fact, as I studied it more and more, I was amazed. Computers came out of Stanford. Fritz Capra and the rest of those people who wrote about physics for the rest of us, what it meant? Berkeley, most of them. In fact, there's a wonderful book called How the Hippies Saved Physics. Music, I don't need to explain, not to this audience. Well, maybe to you young people over there, you don't appreciate. See, I remember how my dad taught. But in any event, over and over and over again, Bay Area was ground zero. Jerusalem, Benares, and San Francisco, the transcendental, the inner, and the immanent paths, taken as a whole, they describe what I term dimensions of perfection. This label arises from my claim that there is an ultimate reality that manifests in different ways, each perfect in a way the others are not. It is not a hierarchy. Mathematicians argue there is more than one kind of infinity. Quantum mechanics is filled with paradoxes. That spiritual perfection takes more than one form is one more liberation from the monotheistic idea that truth is always singular and relations are hierarchical. We should not be surprised. I think I'll stop there because I know how I feel when somebody's reading from a book. So, that basically is what I wanted to cover today. I'm doing additional research for the next book now. It's very, very interesting on what science is doing to our sense of individuality. Because the world that we grew out of had a view of individuals as ultimately self-contained units. That's why you have rights. My rights begin, or your rights end where my nose begins, is a perfect description of that mindset. Or it's my property, I can do with it what I want. And up to a point, it has served us well. But the more connected, interconnected we become, the more the paradoxes start arising, because that's not really how the world is. And now science is discovering the most amazing things about who we are that fits looking at the world as a world of relationships, as an immanent one of consciousness, but completely violates any notion of individuals as atoms of consciousness independent from everything else. For example, in the science of epigenetics, they've discovered that used to be our genes were our fate as modified by our external environment. Now they're discovering they're like this. And so the Germans in World War II, this was a puzzle that epigenetics has solved. The Germans in World War II, when the Allies invaded Europe, were Nazis were always pissed off. And they were really pissed off at the Dutch because the Dutch were on the side of the Allies. So they blockaded a chunk of Holland and wouldn't allow food in. And it took the Allies quite a while to get there. Many thousands starved to death. What they discovered was that the babies of the mothers who survived that tended to be small and have bad health. That was expected. What wasn't expected was that the babies of those babies, once they grew and they'd been fed well and were members of modern society, also were small and had bad health. That what happens to your grandmother can impact how you develop, even though the genome is the same. For a society of interconnection, that's no problem. For a society of Ayn Randians, big problem. Or, my favorite example involves mice. There's a kind of, they raise some mice in a sterile environment, and how the scientists got this idea to do this experiment, I suppose I could track down the journal article and maybe they'll say why they got the idea, maybe. There's a kind of bacteria in the soil that these mice were raised without because they were raised in a sterile environment. And they taught them to run mazes. They learned to run the maze. And they fed some of the mice this bacteria. They ran the mazes a great deal faster. And when they wiped out the bacteria in those mice, over time, their ability to run the maze declined back to just about what it had been before.
But doesn't this all open that Ayn Randian box all over again? By science, because science is primarily in the control of the military-industrial complex, when it has to put these discoveries into usage, that's going to lead to things like transhumanism, where you have, I mean, potentially speaking, you have a situation where, oh, there's too much radiation? Okay, let's give you a genetic fix. Done. But who can afford that? Who can't? Who's going to sit out there and fry because they couldn't afford
Every achievement of the human race to date, so far as I know, has been misused. I'd love to hear a counterexample. At one time I thought Buddhism was different. And then I was reading a history of medieval Tibet, where the Dalai Lama sent his troops down to kill the Panchen Lama, I'm sure with great compassion. And I thought, oh yeah, this sounds real normal. There are all sorts of ways to talk about the role of what we might call evil in the world. That's a whole other talk. That could happen. And it's very possible that some will try it. And it may be possible that technology also could be used to save the people around a nuclear accident. It could be good, it could be bad. I'm not going to go there. I'm talking about what we're discovering about the nature of reality, not how we use that. That's a separate issue. Very, very important, but separate. And that is that it turns out that the intelligence of the mice is related to the presence or absence of bacteria that do not need the mice to live. And mice, being mammals, have brains not that dissimilar from ours.
Smaller.
But not that dissimilar. as I was reading, I thought, that puts a whole new level of meaning on the fact that kids like to eat dirt. I'm serious. There may be a sort of compulsion there. Because I sure as hell can't think why I would want to eat dirt now. But perhaps at one point I did. Because it's a common thing with kids. And you're taking in something that is necessary for the full development of your mind. What does that say about the individual mind? Something very subversive. And then if you look at bacteria, it gets even weirder, because many people who study bacteria say that our way of breaking bacteria into different species and kinds of bacteria is actually mistaken. I marked it, and then I lost it. The what Lynn Margulis found, or some people who studied bacteria. Oh, here we are. Compared to the traditional notion of what constitutes an individual, in an important sense, is bacteria can be considered a single organism widely distributed spatially. A single bacterium, quote, this is Lynn Margulis writing, usually possesses fewer genes than are necessary for a bacterial strain to exist alone in any natural environment, end quote. Yet they certainly have no difficulty flourishing. They do so because bacteria continually share DNA among themselves, crossing species lines and changing from form to form based on the biological environment. As they do, they draw on the gene pool of all other bacteria, living and dead. This ability explains why resistance to antibiotics can appear in one species of bacteria and quickly spread to other species. Margulis describes such a phenomena with respect to E. coli. Quote, a commonly found inhabitant of the human gut. Quote, if you put a particular plasmid into E. coli, all of a sudden you have a Klebsiella and not E. coli. You've changed not only the species, but the genus. It's like changing a person into a chimpanzee. Can you imagine doing that, putting a chimpanzee in the refrigerator and getting him out the next morning, and now he's a person? This apparently is how bacteria work. And so not only are we as individuals potentially, this is very cutting edge, it's only in the last few months that some of this has been discovered, about the mice, are at least mouse brains, and therefore at least potentially mammal brains, but I don't think it would be ethical to do the experiment on humans this way, influenced by bacteria in terms of our intelligence, which is part of our mind. But in addition, bacteria may well be, in many respects, one species spread throughout the world. They act as one species, but not spatially located. And indeed, many scientists are moving in this direction on a number of other issues. E.O. Wilson has just made a similar argument about ants. That ants are not a superorganism, they are one organism. And that all the ants we see are robots of their queen. It's a fascinating argument. And he's pretty much universally regarded as the world's expert on ants. We're talking about as heavy a hitter in evolutionary biology as you can get, who interestingly has also, from these studies, abandoned the selfish gene hypothesis that he was partly responsible for pushing, which was very popular with the Randroid group. So, this is where the next book will go, looking more into relationship and redefining how we think about individuality. Not that it doesn't exist, but it's the our ability to harmonize and integrate relationships leads to an ever richer
individuality. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, and thank you all for coming tonight. Let me point out that we have a donation bowl over there. We encourage you to contribute to it so that we can share that with our speaker to further his work and also to retain this space for future such events. Of course, Fault Lines is available right here. Will be signed, I'm sure, with pleasure by the author as well as some of his other work as well. So do check that out on your way out. Thank you again for coming tonight, and thank you again, Gus.
And thank you for coming and sitting and listening to me this long.